David Mark was born in 1951. In that year, the top-rated TV shows were Texaco Star Theater, Fireside Theater, Philco TV Playhouse, and Your Show of Shows. Of course, Mark was too young to watch in 1951, but he says that like most Americans his age and younger, he was an avid TV watcher long before he learned to read. He remembers spending many Saturday mornings in his Brooklyn apartment envying Joey Newton because he had both a TV show and a horse named Fury. TV informed Mark's fantasy life as a child. As an adult, he's come to think of TV as our shared culture. Since the mid-70s, he's been studying television history. He's described the subject of his writing as, quote, living with television and the culture that turns it on, creates it, rewards it, despises it, forgets it, and remembers it, unquote. David Mark has written for The Atlantic and The Village Voice and is an assistant professor at Brandeis University. His new book is about the evolution of the sitcom. It's called Comic Visions, Television Comedy and American Culture. Many of the old sitcoms he writes about are now on cable, where they've been repackaged as morality tales, nostalgia, or camp. But that doesn't quite describe David Mark's approach to watching them.
In a sense, I watch them as autobiography. If I'm watching, let's say, Nick at Night, Car 54, Where Are You? Will come up. In an objective sense, we're talking about 1962. In a personal sense, we're talking about me being 11 years old. And very much like oldies on the radio, they have a tremendous power, these artifacts of the moment, to recreate that moment for us.
Now, something that you've observed about Car 54, for instance, the program you just mentioned, is that it was the only show in a 15-year span in which there were regular black characters who weren't servants or domestics.
Yes, well, one of the things that I particularly like about that program, which was done by Nat Hiken, whose other work includes Sergeant Bilko, is that it has a real style to it. First of all, it was done in New York City during a period in which virtually all television production outside of the news had moved to California. Car 54 was shot at the old Biograph studio in the Bronx, where D.W. Griffith had made some of his silent era epics before moving to the West Coast. And you'll see street scenes of the Bronx in it. You have a variety of ethnic characters. And this was during the white bread period of the sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have, you know, Father Knows Best and Ozzie and Harriet and the Donna Reed Show and Leave It to Beaver really ruling the genre. And here is this crazy show where people are talking Yiddish and black characters are appearing in it and Italian characters. It really was almost a throwback to radio, where ethnicity had been very popular. I think one of the reasons ethnicity was popular on radio was that it was something you could do with sound. You could invoke the ethnic group with the accent, like in shows like Life with Luigi and the Goldbergs and so forth.
Well, as they point out, yeah, the shows like the Goldbergs and Amos and Andy started off on, you know, came to TV after radio, but they didn't last very long. Do you have suggested reasons why they didn't last long on TV, the ethnic shows?
Yeah, because what happened was when you took this exotic radio voice and put it on television, what had become something, you know, pleasant to listen to became a kind of racist joke. Think of the fact, for example, that Amos and Andy were played by two white men on the radio imitating black voices. A better example is the radio sitcom Beulah, in which a white man played the part of a black woman doing this voice. Now, when they went over to television, they actually considered, in the case of Amos and Andy, of having the two white stars, Freeman Gosden and Charles Correll, who also created and wrote that program, of having them do the show in blackface. But, of course, that really would have been going much, much too far, and especially during a period where civil rights consciousness is beginning to come to some sort of fulcrum. You know, we're leading up to 1954 here in Brown versus Board of Education. So they went over to black actors. But here were black actors playing these stereotypes. And it truly became a kind of tasteless, racist joke at that point.
Your new book, Comic Visions, is really a history, in a way, of comedy on television. And you point out that at the beginning of television, when television first began, that there were a lot of shows, variety shows, hosted by people who had been stand-up comics, Milton Berle and Sid Caesar were two of the first big TV stars. But that finally sitcoms won out over sketch comedy and stand-up comedy. Why did that happen? You describe it as the comics being exiled to late night.
Yes. Today, for example, stand-up comedy is tremendously popular. Yet look at primetime television. There isn't a single regularly scheduled program that features stand-up comedy in all of prime time. And the reason for this is because in the early days, when they were experimenting, they tried all kinds of things. What they found was that there was something about comedy variety, sketch comedy and stand-up, that is, which was undependable. If Don Rickles or Milton Berle or whoever it was on, great. But what if they weren't on? What if they had a bad night? Think of it this way. If a stand-up comedian does a routine and the routine bombs, is it possible to say, okay, well, we'll retake that. Go out and do it again in front of the audience. Well, forget it. What could be worse than that? Whereas in sitcom, you can impose a kind of quality control by retaking the dramatic episodes. So it's like as the stakes became larger in prime time, how could you go to a big sponsor, a Procter & Gamble or a Pepsi Cola, and say, well, we think you should sponsor this show because the comedian is really good? That's a very abstract thing. However, when you could show them a finished product in the can, a product that could be modified, that could be changed, things could be taken out, it could be tested on focus groups and so forth. Well, you had something where quality control could be imposed. You didn't have to depend upon the comedian having a good evening.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that took a great deal of the early spontaneity out of television. The so-called golden age of Milton Berle and Sid Caesar, that was really an experimental period, and the experiment was a failure.
David Mark is my guest, and his new book, Comic Visions, is about television comedy and American culture. You describe the early family suburban sitcoms as upholding gender roles, and you write, I want to quote you, you write, Lucy's schemes became ritual celebrations of female deference to patriarchal structures. I want to know if you thought in those terms at all when you were a child watching these shows. And I ask this because I certainly didn't, but on the other hand, there was always something that really frustrated me about The Honeymooners and about I Love Lucy. And I think I really felt that the women in those shows were really cramped, that Alice really had it bad. She was never going to get out of the house. She didn't seem to really love Jackie Gleason, except for the very end when they made up. Lucille Ball was always failing in her schemes and never getting fulfillment and always being put in her place. There was something hopeless about it to me, even though they were comedies.
Yeah, I think just on a kid's level, the fact that Ricky was in show business, and Lucy wanted to be in show business. And why couldn't Lucy be in show business? Because Ricky said so, that she should be home, you know, like cooking dinner and taking care of little Ricky, just as a kind of fait accompli, and no further explanation was necessary. But I would disagree with you in that I think that Lucy and Alice Cramden were very different characters. And Alice Cramden really could scream back in a way that Lucy never could.
Mm-hmm.
Lucy, at the end of every episode, after seeing the error of her ways, that she shouldn't go into show business, that she should be home doing the housework and so forth, sort of has to own up to Ricky and cry, you know, her famous wah, and, apologize. She'd just say, I'm sorry, honey, you know, and kiss him and so forth. Alice doesn't do that. Alice is angry. She's got all kinds of class anger and gender anger going on there. And when they make up at the end, it's just sort of superimposed on this narrative as a deus ex machina. It really doesn't come from anywhere. I think Alice is maybe the prototype of a female character that would emerge 20 years later, perhaps, and get her revenge.
You see the Dick Van Dyke Show as a real pivot point in TV sitcoms. What's special about it?
Yeah, the Dick Van Dyke Show was all alone in this period during the Kennedy era. It was neither an Eisenhower sitcom, as, let's say, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, and the Donna Reed Show were, nor was it the Mary Tyler Moore Show, All in the Family, or MASH. It was the missing link between those two things. And there was a kind of progress going on there, where you have the wife who is still the housewife, yet Laura is given to us as someone who had a career as a dancer, who has talents and so forth. There are episodes in which she resumes her career, even. I think what happened, though, that prevented a clean and easy movement to the later shows that I mentioned was the Vietnam War, where that whole process of gender role development was stopped in its tracks. And we go into this regression period of magic sitcoms like Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie, because suddenly these observations about American family life, which had been very simple and innocent, became polarized because of political content.
And TV couldn't cope with it. That's when TV was really lagging very, very far behind the culture.
And no genre worse than the sitcom. I mean, if you look at the cop show, you've got the Mod Squad, you know, attempts to integrate women and blacks into the sort of archetypal white middle-aged crime fighter. Youth joins the police force and so forth. But here was the sitcom, the most representational form of all that's supposed to be showing us in our own home. And all of a sudden, genies and witches and Martians, it was a way of escaping from its representational heritage. And I think you also have the tremendous popularity of these rural sitcoms during a period when rural America is fast disappearing. The 60s were dominated by shows like The Beverly Hillbillies, which was the number one sitcom in terms of ratings for that entire decade, and other shows by Paul Henning, such as Green Acres and Petticoat Junction. And this is these are the most popular shows while, you know, riots are taking place in the streets and Vietnam protests are going on. Think of this. Gomer Pyle was set in the Marines during the principal period of U.S. troop involvement in Vietnam. And it's the story of a contemporary Marine. And the main problem in life is how to have a deep and caring relationship with your sergeant. You know, right. You never hear anything about the war or even about Vietnam. Curiously, there's one mention of Vietnam that takes place during in the sitcom during the late 60s. And this was in a show called Julia. Julia was interesting because after the cancellation of Amos and Andy and Beulah in the early 50s, there was about a 15-year period where blacks simply didn't appear in any sitcoms. In 67, NBC brought Diane Carroll into a sitcom vehicle called Julia about a nurse who is a widow whose husband has died on the line in Vietnam. And the reason that was done was to sort of preempt criticism of the show by having the black character in it tied up with patriotism and so forth, in that her, you know, mm-hmm. her husband had died in the war.
You know, in talking about how well, really how poorly television did in handling the turmoil of the 60s and the cultural changes of the 60s, I want to bring up the subject of the Smothers Brothers. Many people have fond memories of what a provocative show that was, about how they took on the Vietnam War and other real subjects of the time, the counterculture. You went back and watched some of those shows and thought they didn't hold up at all.
No, they were mostly pretty boring. Though one thing that did interest me about this was the fact that the sitcom, which had so, as we discussed, so thoroughly triumphed over comedy variety, there was an attempt to bring back comedy variety in the late 60s. And the two great successes of that attempt were Laugh-In and the Smothers Brothers Show. And both of those shows had heavy political content in them within the context of what was going on in television at that time. The sketch material is awful. I mean, you know, if you in the ensuing 15 years or so, if you've been watching Saturday Night Live or SCTV or you know, other late night comedy shows, you absolutely wince at the kind of stuff that the Smothers Brothers were doing. The most interesting thing about it is as a historical artifact to see Pete Seeger, for example, singing an anti-war song during the Vietnam War. Yet with cable today and you know, other opportunities for television, it really seems kind of trivial to even have made a big deal about that.
It was sitcoms like The Mary Tyler Moore Show, MASH, and All in the Family that brought a new cultural relevance back into the form. You say that when Mary Tyler Moore was originally written, before it made it onto TV, she was supposed to be divorced. But the person from CBS Research didn't like that. He said there were three things that the audience wouldn't stand for: people with mustaches, people living in New York, and people who are divorced. Those three weird things to point out.
Yes, well...
Was the mustache a joke, by the way?
No, facial hair was considered to be a very negative thing based on focus groups that were done.
A hippie trait, yeah.
It was a hippie trait or, you know, weirdo professors or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see beards on characters in old sitcoms almost always to indicate that they're some sort of social deviant.
Mm-hmm. Is this a turning point for the role of research in television, where you've got somebody from CBS saying she can't be divorced, the American public isn't ready for that yet, make her just... single?
No, it's not a turning point in research, in the sense that the research has always been done. What it proves is that this research is by no means scientific. I mean, here's the problem. You want to go to a big corporation and have them spend $500,000 to advertise on a show. You can't say to them, we think you ought to spend $500,000 for 30 seconds of time, because this is a wonderful show. This is terrific. Everyone in the office loved it. What you have to do is show them charts and graphs to scientifically prove that housewives making between and families that make between $10,000 and $25,000 a year cannot resist this. And so these sort of phony sciences, usually under the umbrella of the word demographics, have been invented. And... using the rubric of science, this is given as hard information. Of course, it's not hard information at all. Michael Dan at CBS at that period didn't think a divorced woman could go. It had never been done before, and he didn't want to do it. So he went out and had the questionnaire survey research done that proved his point. Well, somebody else went out and proved that it could be done. This is not science.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have Mary Tyler Moore, MASH, and All in the Family bringing a new literary level, in a way, into the sitcom. And then black characters start returning to the sitcom in shows like Sanford and Son and The Jeffersons. And then you say that the literate sitcoms are just replaced by Gary Marshall's return to normalcy, shows like Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Mork and Mindy. What changed in the climate of television?
Well, I think it's more what changed in the climate of American culture. You had this kind of euphoria at the end of the 60s in popular culture, where there was a new set of rising consumer heroes. Women now were controlling a much larger percentage of the consumer dollar. A black middle class that had to be appealed to was beginning to emerge. And youth was replacing older viewers. For example... previous wisdom had always been that you wanted to sell to 35 to 49-year-olds. Now it became clear that more money was being spent by 18 to 34-year-olds. I mean, this is the kind of memos, these are the kind of memos that were passing around at that time. Well, in order to reach these new groups, you had to refigure the heroes of these programs. So you get a show like All in the Family, where father doesn't know best, but father knows least. You get a show like MASH, where the military is shown not to be some paragon of virtue, but you get a pretty dismal image of the military. And the Mary Tyler Moore Show, where a single woman with a job is shown not as somebody who is in a trap, who really would prefer to have a husband and move to the suburbs, but actually likes to live that way. You know, about the Mary Tyler Moore Show, there had been... quote, working girl sitcoms going back to the early 50s. The Ann Southern Show mm-hmm. was one of them. Our Miss Brooks was another one. But in those shows, the woman was shown as trapped in this horrible situation where she was either trying to marry her boss, in the case of Ann Southern, or the biology teacher, as in the case of Our Miss Brooks. But now this was a real difference. Mary seemed satisfied with her life. The guys she dated were often jerks, and she was well rid of them. The fact that this was also happening to a greater degree with more single women around, with more women postponing marriage to later on in life, this was no coincidence. This was finding the new consumer heroin.
Let's move ahead to the present. I'm curious what you think of the nuclear family shows that are on now, shows like Cosby, Roseanne, Family Ties, Growing Pains. I know that don't fall neatly under one description or opinion for you, but do you think that they, like their predecessors, are upholding traditional values, or are they taking a different cultural view? Do you enjoy the shows?
I think that there is a lot of continuity there, and that there's a lot more variety than there once was. For example, The Cosby Show and Growing Pains are often pointed to as, you know, Father Knows Best a la the 1980s. But at the same time, you'll have a show like My Two Dads.
Right.
the premise of this show is that a little girl being brought up by her mother, and the mother has died, and it's not clear where paternity can be pinned in this, and there are two candidates, and so the judge demands that she move in with the two possible fathers, and they both bring her up. Now, this kind of thing could never have happened before All in the Family and shows like that, because of the sort of updating of the mimetic agenda that that Norman Lear did. By that I mean there had to be a refiguring of this pastoral family situation. Another interesting thing that happened to the black sitcom, especially in the 70s, was you had shows like Webster and Different Strokes. The idea that... both of these shows, I think, are shows where the producers would talk about progressive values, how they wanted to show blacks and whites living harmoniously and so forth. But if you look at these shows, you have black children who are being brought up by white millionaires and or wealthy upper middle class white people, and somehow they end up being just like white children. And it's a very dire implication there, that somehow if you could take black children away from the ghetto and place them with these all-knowing, all-loving white parents, they would turn out to be these little model citizens. So I think, you know, it's gone off in a lot of different directions since those changes were made. But I think the important thing was that at the time, people believed that the sitcom was entering into this sort of new world of, permanently progressing complexity. And it wasn't true at all. Shows like Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley and, to some degree, Different Strokes showed that the sitcom could return to its sort of silly and banal heritage just as easily.
In your first book, Demographic Vistas, you wrote that you were convinced that American television had defined itself as a comic medium. Do you still think that's true?
Yes. And in fact, I think that it bolsters the point to look at these so-called dramas, shows like L.A. Law, and even to some degree Wise Guy, which really depend on their comedy to be interesting. L.A. Law, devoid of its comic lines, in other words, with simply its more dramatic or tragic aspects, would be an utterly boring program. The comedy is really what makes it happen. And I think that some of the best energy in comedy, especially at MTM Studios, realized that they were at a kind of cul-de-sac with the sitcom, and that they needed to move over into this dramatic situation to do even better comedy than they had done previously.
What are your favorite shows on television now? Are there shows you look forward to every week?
Yeah, I really like Wise Guy a lot. I think that... Ken Wall's performance in it and generally the writing of it is very, very strong, very full of allusion, making fun of everything from the record industry to television. I think people in popular culture tend to do the best job, especially with satire, when they make fun of themselves. If you wanted to find out about the Napoleonic Wars, better off going to the library. But if you want to find out about the TV industry or the entertainment industry, turn on TV, especially shows like Wise Guy and L.A. Law, which are full of good criticism of television itself.
Mm-hmm. How much time a day do you think you spend watching TV?
Well, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. I would say that most of the time I spend watching TV is spent switching channels. There's no reason most of the time to stick with any image on the 40-channel cable spectrum for any time longer than it's interesting. So I'll watch something on one channel. What will that be? Something interesting visually, a bit of dialogue, a sex object, well, whatever it might be. And the moment, even the vaguest hint or notion of boredom enters into it, switch to the next image. And so this idea of prospecting or searching is much more interesting. The montage one creates is far more interesting than the vast majority of the shows. I know that this is a horror for sponsors and for the industry, but it's simply true. And it may force them to come up with programs that are more interesting than the montage.
You teach television at Brandeis University, and you've written two books about it, many articles about it. What do you say to the people who think that television is ruining or has already ruined the American mind?
I think that there could be no more eloquent reason of why it needs to be studied. This division between high culture and low culture and trying to keep low culture out of the academy has simply become a device for people to protect little fiefdoms in literature or film or, you know, whatever it is they're doing. If an English department were truly interested in the English language, it would in fact be teaching more courses on television, which has become the vessel of the language, than it would in literature.
Well, David, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Terry.